So there's an exchange constant that that governs the interaction between sigma z on site I and j, where I and j are always nearest neighbors. So that's what this notation means when you have these angle brackets. Okay. So this is the Ising part of the Hamiltonian. This is the transverse field because this is a sigma x operator. These are all poly operators. So what we're going to do is essentially look at the phase diagram of this model first. We're going to derive or argue for the different phases that occur as a function of, you know, J, H, and an external heat bath or a temperature. Before we do that, let me just say a note about the symmetries of this Hamiltonian. And by symmetry, essentially, we mean under what, I guess, you know, operations or what quantum operators is this Hamiltonian invariant under, right? So what unitary can you apply to the Hamiltonian such that it doesn't change? And if the Hamiltonian doesn't change, you expect that the states, you know, the ground states that arise due to this Hamiltonian are also invariant, essentially. And in the cases where they're not, this is when you have sort of non-trivial symmetry breaking. This basically defines what we mean by a phase on the phase diagram and so on. So in this case, I'll just write down the unitary that is the generator for the symmetry group. And it's very simple for the transverse field Ising model. So I'm not really deriving this, I'm just stating what it is. U is a product. Of sigma x, so poly operators, sigma x. And this unitary, by definition, acts on the Hilbert space of the model. Okay, and it does this in a certain way. So to produce different consequences for different operators. Okay, and this is basically how we derive the sort of symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So we can look at the different operators that can occur. We have a sigma z operator. So what this unitary is doing is basically applying a product or, you know, of all possible sigma x or j going from 1 to n. And so it's essentially flipping all the spins, if you want to think of it, in the sigma z basis, right? Then it's reading out, you know, one of the spins and then flipping them all back. But if you actually just, you know, just basically write down the matrices associated with this, do the matrix multiplication, you'll see that the matrix multiplication of sigma x, you know, sigma z sandwich in between two sigma x's will just give you back sigma z minus sigma z. Similarly, if you did it for y, and of course, sigma x is special, and it gives you the same thing back through matrix multiplication. So now when you take these, if you take this unitary and apply it to the Hamiltonian, the sign of this term will be unchanged because nothing changes in the sigma x operator. Each one of these will pick up a minus sign that cancels. And so your Hamiltonian is invariant under operation by this unitary, if you will. I was using curly H's last time for Hamiltonians. So this unitary U is a symmetry of H, also means they commute. The eigenvalues of this unitary are plus or minus 1. And in the language of group theory, a group is formed by this generator. Use a generator of the group. You know which group it generates? Have you seen this before? Who's taking group theory? I haven't, so. So when you hear people talk about a symmetry of a Hamiltonian, basically what they're deriving is the group under which the transformations, generators of that group leave the Hamiltonian invariant. And this type of unitary, or this generator, forms a group called a Z2 group, Z2 permutation group. So together with the identity, so Z2 symmetry. So that's just adding a bit of rigor to the definition of what Z2 symmetry means. So this Hamiltonian is invariant under a Z2 symmetry, or a Z2 symmetry. this is supposed to, the elements of this group, the identity operator and this unitary, this is supposed to remind you of basically like 1 and minus 1 under multiplication as an operation. Okay, and so it's the same idea. It's like if you take sigma z, sigma z, and flip the sign of it, that's kind of like the symmetry under which you're invariant, right? It's this thing here. This is kind of the important element of that group. So this is a low symmetry. There's only two elements in that group. You can have higher symmetry Hamiltonians or higher symmetry models. So if an XY model, which is like SX, SX, I'll write it down. So these are still, let's say, spin 1/2 operators. Forgot my sum. Okay, so you can imagine having an in-plane. There's no sigma z component here. You just have sort of in-plane spin 1/2 operators. Classically, this would have an O2 symmetry, so it would be invariant under operations within the group of O2. But quantum mechanically, it has a U1 symmetry. This is the same symmetry that gives you particle conservation in a model of like bosons hopping or something, hardcore bosons, for example. That's a common symmetry that you'll see in condensed matter. For the Heisenberg model, also spin 1/2. S So all three components now instead of just two is another higher symmetry. This is SU2 symmetric. Again, I won't derive these groups, but basically you have to come up with sort of the generators of the group and so on. But this is just the quantum, if you will, equivalence of O2 symmetry, which is like in-plane rotor symmetry, and O3 symmetry, which would be like a three-dimensional rotor or something like that. So just keep these in mind if you're ever dealing with condensed matter models and people say, oh, that's an SU2 invariant or an SU2 symmetric Hamiltonian. Basically, that's what it means. This is how you generate that symmetry classification by, you know, permutation group in the simplest case. We have a sort of an aside. We'll use the symmetry operation when we look at the phase diagram. But let's state our goal here. Let's explore. And the phase diagram, if you haven't encountered this terminology before, is literally just a diagram that labels the different phases as a function of the parameters in that Hamiltonian. You know, J, H, and say temperature. So in order to determine what the phase diagram is, you'll have to use your prerequisites. Which means basically stat mech, thermodynamics, and a bit of quantum mechanics. So, specifically, you have to think about what kind of ensemble you're in. Right, we have a whole bunch of spins. We have n spins. Maybe they're sitting on a hypercubic lattice. That's sort of implied by this notation. So we're going to work in the ensemble where we have a fixed number of spins. Then, in the canonical ensemble, we have a certain definition for the probability of a energy eigenstate, say. And by energy eigenstate, I mean something that satisfies the eigenequation like this. Maybe I want to label my energy with the energy eigenstate. So that probability I would write as 1 over z e to the minus beta e, where beta is the inverse temperature, remember, 1 over kVT. Okay, hopefully this is all review for you guys. That partition function is the trace, which I could write in the energy eigen basis is just the sum over n, or more generally, e to the minus beta, just just trace over e to the minus beta h, of course. So once we've defined this ensemble, the idea of a temperature, we can define expectation values of operators. Call the operator O and the energy eigenbasis. Or I can write that out as a trace. Over the partition function. Something like that. This is a trace.
Oh, that's a trace.
Yeah. Sorry. That's an R. Yeah, so if you're in a different basis, it's just it's the equivalent of this sum essentially, but it can be that's a basis independent way of writing it. And these are traces here. And usually what a trace means for us is some sort of sum over states, right? So not necessarily energy eigenstates, but we can take traces over all sorts of different states. So okay, so yeah, basically I'm just defining some notation here that we'll use. So we know how to, okay, so we're in a fixed number of spins, we know how to define expectation values. We need some thermodynamics. Specifically free energies. Okay, so I won't review all of thermodynamics. Basically, minimizing a free energy is a common tool that we use to figure out ground state phase diagrams. Okay, so let's use all of our tools to explore this phase diagram. We're setting our Boltzmann constant and our Planck constant to 1. And we need units for our temperature, essentially, and our energies. And we'll pick the units of J. So then our phase diagram is written in terms of H over J and T over J. Okay, that's basically the choice of our units is J. So that sets the energy scale in the problem. This J here. So anytime we have a transition temperature, it's a T over J. Anytime we have a transition field, it's an H over J. Okay?
So you need to Planck constant to 1 and what else?
And I usually set this Boltzmann constant to 1 here.
Okay.
I haven't done anything with it yet, but I'm just warning you that it'll happen and I'll forget. But what I want to emphasize by saying that is that these are the, J is the unit of energy that we're interested in when we draw these phase diagrams. Okay. So figuring out the phase diagram is basically figuring out what's going on here in terms of differentiating between different states, different ground states. Okay. And a ground state is defined by, again, the broken symmetry that occurs very simply. So it's something that we can determine via expectation values of operators. And we also might need to know something about the excitations. or the topological invariance, like I mentioned last time. You know, basically, we're looking for some sort of idea about what's going on in this. You know, maybe there's phase one, phase two, phase three. We basically want to draw those boundaries and label the phases. That's not what it looks like, by the way. So we'll start looking at special cases. We'll start basically on the axes, okay? And we'll determine whether or not there's phase boundaries on the axes, and then extrapolate the rest of the phase diagram. Question?
How do you know define the boundary between phase one and some other phase?
That it's defined by the phase transition, which is a very correct. Yeah. So you'll either have you'll have some sort of singularity in that free energy derivative or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one thing we're trying to do here is identify phases and phase transitions, right? And so let's talk about how you do that now, I guess. So let's choose one of these. Which one do I want to do? Let's do H equals zero first. Zero transverse field. So we're basically staying on this axis here. And we're asking, what's going on with the phases and phase transitions on this axis? Okay, so this is a very well-known case. It's just the Ising model. On a d-dimensional hypercubic lattice. Okay, and because we've got rid of the transverse field, essentially, the sigma z operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, it's a good quantum number. That's the description of the state that we're going to be looking at. So in terms of that sigma z, or the expectation value of that sigma z operator, at t equals 0, so first here, what are the two possible ground states of the model at zero temperature?
Everything points up,
everything points down. Right. So we can write those as basically n arrows pointing up, right? Or n arrows pointing down. They minimize the energy. That's one way to think about it. You're at zero temperature, right? So you have no entropy. You're always trying to minimize the free energy to figure out what the state of the system is. The principle of free energy or something that's called. What that means is you're trying to maximize, the entropy. So if you have some sort of probability distribution and you're trying to estimate the probability distribution, you want to give it no additional constraints so that you're not biasing yourself anyway. So that's why you maximize entropy all the time. And it turns into a minimization of free energy because your energy is conserved. Okay. So in order to determine the ground state from this Hamiltonian, you set that second term to zero, and then you're just minimizing the energy. And the energy is just given by this classical Hamiltonian, right? There's a minus sign out front. So every time a spin's aligned, two spins are aligned, two neighboring spins are aligned on any lattice, essentially, then you'll want this thing to Yeah, so this thing will give you a minus, you know, j or something like that. And you add up all those minus j's. So this is all sigma up, all sigma down. This gives an energy. Which I'll call E naught. Okay, so it's minus. There's, let's see, n spins. And if you're on a hypercube, right, so there's in one dimension you have one bond, two dimensions you have two bonds, three dimensions you have three bonds. So there's minus ndj is the ground state energy. Very generally on any hypercubic lattice. This is called the ferromagnetic phase. Excitations out of the ground state raise the energy. This is the lowest possible energy. And we'll talk about excitations lots. And you have to be a little more careful when you think about excitations. You might want to look in higher dimensions, so higher than one. So one excitation would be flipping one spin. So what that flip spin does is basically cost you energy in all of these bonds. So the ground state is modified. So the energy in this case, for one flip spin, right? So each of these bonds was giving you a minus j before. Okay, so you have, you know, you basically have two for every dimension. Like you have these two for two dimensions, and then you have the opposing ones. And so you're raising yourself by 2d, and the energy of each bond goes from minus to positive, so it's 2j. So we'll look at the energy of those excitations in general. So if you think about this a little bit before we go on, you might ask, which one of these two states does the system choose? All right, so we're building up a picture here on the phase diagram, somewhere around this zero point. I'm arguing that there's some sort of, you know, ground state, at least strictly at the zero temperature, zero field limit. But which one of these does a thermodynamic system choose? Do you know? I know you know a Mac. Can anyone tell me what happens?
Randomly.
Right, so what's that process called? Where it randomly chooses one of those two.
Gambling.
Sorry, what?
Symmetry breaking.
Right, it's called symmetry breaking, but specifically what kind of symmetry breaking?
Spontaneous.
Sorry?
Spontaneous.
Spontaneous. Did you say spontaneous? That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Spontaneous symmetry breaking is something a little subtle about this. I mean, you have two of these possible low energy states. So let's just. Let's just make an aside here about this apparent paradox. Naively in the ground state, you have these two different possibilities.
Okay. I don't know how to spell naively.
If you did a proper trace in the ground state, so if you did a proper trace here, you would actually trace over both of these possibilities. So a little more technically, you can imagine calculating the expectation value of the sigma operator, sigma z operator, on some site I. Right? So you know what it is in each one of those two ground states. And you know how to calculate it. It's with that formula right over there. So sigma z e to the minus beta h. One way to imagine taking that trace is to apply the symmetry. I've erased it. But to apply the generator of the symmetry group u, which leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. That's what I proved here. So what does that Hamiltonian symmetry do when you apply it to this expectation value? You could ask that. There's many different ways to sort of think about this paradox, but let me do that. Let me apply the Z2 symmetry operator. It's the same as saying calculate the expectation value in both of those ground states, essentially. But it should leave the state invariant because it's a symmetry of the system. So u dagger u. And I can insert another u dagger u in the middle here. Sigma z u dagger u minus beta h u. And we know what we get from applying that symmetry to the sigma z operator, we get a minus out. And here, we apply to the Boltzmann weight, or whatever you want to call that thing. Well, it contains the Hamiltonian. Any function of an operator is defined by its Taylor expansion. So you can imagine Taylor expanding that exponential out, and then applying the unitary to each occurrence of h. And nothing happens. So this term should just be e to the minus beta h. And this term will give you minus sigma z. And if you work that trace out, you would see that you would get minus the expectation value. And the only way that the expectation value can be equal to minus the expectation value is if it's zero. Which is another way of saying, if I traced over these two ground states, and say I picked a spin here, here, and I added up the expectation value of that spin, you would get zero, right? That's just a fancy, group generator symmetry way of saying that. So what's the resolution to this paradox? Pardon?
Well, you're taking an average over all possible configurations.
Yeah, so basically, the resolution is that it doesn't, you shouldn't take the average over all possible configurations. You should do what they said in Mac and just randomly choose one. But that process by which you randomly choose one is only well-defined in the thermodynamic limit. And that's called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And this is what happens in real materials. If you have a real ferromagnetic material, it doesn't exist in some crazy superposition of two states classically, right? It'll just choose one or the other. And it's not actually random. I mean, it depends on sort of external perturbations and so on, which one it chooses. But theoretically, spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs as an order of limits phenomenon. So these two states essentially have the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. They have the Z2 symmetry. And that Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken in a real physical system, which can be seen. And by breaking a symmetry, I mean the resulting state has lower symmetry. Right? So it means it's no longer invariant under that Z2 operation. This is that Z2 operation here, right? If I'm invariant under that Z2 operation, I get this paradox where I can't have any magnetization. So I have to spontaneously break that symmetry. So there's some outside mechanism which basically breaks that invariance or that symmetry. If I take the Hamiltonian and apply a small parallel field, which is defined as a sigma z field, so this is it's essentially some field that couples to the order parameter. This is how you choose this mechanism for spontaneous symmetry breaking. I know the quote-unquote order parameter. I know the symmetry of the ground state. I couple to it, so I break that symmetry, because this magnetic field will choose all spins pointing up and not all spins pointing down. It's a global field. It'll pick one of those. And if I put a plus sign here, I would choose the other one. So if I apply a small symmetry breaking field, a small term which couples to the order parameter, and then I take the thermodynamic limit first. So take the limit. And then take the limit of field goes to zero from above second. Then we'll get a finite expectation value. So if that in that limit, so limit h parallel goes to zero after the limit of n goes to infinity of sigma I z. Then the Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. So I'll leave working that out as an exercise or maybe an assignment question. We do it explicitly in 705, where we're dealing with actual statistical mechanical sort of StatMech models. But I think it's important enough that I mention it here. You know, there's subtleties in the theoretical treatments of these highly symmetric Hamiltonians, but they're well understood in terms of relating these things to physical phenomena. If you didn't have spontaneous symmetry breaking, you wouldn't have a ferromagnetic phase, you know? So it's a very important mechanism that you essentially need in physical systems. Question?
So why do you need to take the thermodynamic limit first?
Well, by taking the thermodynamic limit first, it tells you something. It tells you that spontaneous symmetry breaking only occurs in the infinite size limit.
But why is that? That's what I don't understand.
That's the entire statement. You need to have an infinite size system in order to have a well-defined, you know, broken symmetry in a ground state. If you have a finite size system, you basically don't have this first limit, for example. You don't have n equals infinity. In finite size systems, things are either more subtle or less subtle, depending how you think about it. There's actually no phase transitions. There's no phase transitions in a thermodynamic sense. So there's no strict singularities in free energy derivatives or anything like that. So all of this theory, you know, the theory of systems, many body systems in the thermodynamic limit, the theories of condensed matter and StatMech and thermodynamics basically rely on the thermodynamic limit. That's what I'm saying. So in a many body system, if we want to define things like phases and we want to define things like phase transitions, we basically need these mechanisms. So it's another argument for why we're talking about thermodynamic limits, I would guess. Then we can use the full mechanism of phases and phase transitions from StatMech. Okay, so that's food for thought. What it means is I'll often be considering just one of these two states. You know, I'll choose one of those two possible ground states. All right, I bet you thought this would go faster, right? But we're still sitting at this. We just had a complicated explanation for why we have a ferromagnet at this zero point, this zero, zero point of the phase diagram. All right. So what happens here is you'll have a ground state that's one of these two, and it's randomly chosen, if you want to say those words. It's spontaneously chosen. So now, does that ferromagnetic phase exist when I turn the temperature on? What do you guys think? Is it stable thermally?
No.
That's one right answer. Yes or no, it depends. It actually depends on the dimension of the system. And so how do you know, right? Well, basically you have to look at the free energy associated with this type of excitation, right? So start forming an excitation and ask whether or not that red minority droplet proliferates throughout the system and destroys the phase. That's one way of asking that question. That's called the Pyrrhos argument. So question? Amazing. So Pyrrhos argued for the existence of a phase transition or a phase boundary on this horizontal axis, but only in certain dimensions. So now we have to, you know, we've been considering general dimensions. D is our spatial dimension here. So now we have to generalize this a bit. So let's look at different dimensions. So let's start with the case of d equals 1.
Okay, so consider this droplet of minority spins, the red spins, in a sea or in the ferromagnetic background. So let me draw a real space picture. I got some up spins. I have some down spins. And I'm in the thermodynamic limit. So there's an energy cost, again, associated with that minority droplet. So actually what happens thermally is you can imagine the ferromagnetic state just existing, it all spins up, and then one of these spins flip, and there's a boundary of there's a defect boundary. And it actually, it involves two bonds, right? So if I flip one of these, there's two bonds that are violated. Those two bonds are also violated regardless of the size of the droplet. Okay, so the energy cost of that droplet so it's a ground state energy plus dimensions 1, right? So it's just plus 4j. So the energy cost of that droplet is independent of the size of that droplet. Let me call the size of that thing L. Independent of droplet size, L.
Sorry, where's the second factor of 2 come from?
So on a hypercube, all right, so, well, yeah, I'll draw it here. But so if I have a minority spin, and I have spin up, actually that sum is over all nearest neighbors in the Hamiltonian. So I also have to account for these two bonds. So you see that factor of 2. So that's 2d in the formula. But then also each bond has gone from an energy cost of minus j to plus j, right? Which is it's a distance of 2. So it's 2d, 2j. Okay, so that's the energy cost. But the energy isn't the thing. I mean, if we're talking about finite temperatures, energy is not the only thing that's important. We have to consider the free energy. So in order to consider the free energy, we need E minus TS. We need the entropy. And the free energy is a thing which the system will minimize. It'll choose a state that minimizes the free energy. So we need an estimate for the entropy gain associated with having a droplet of size L.
So there's different ways of doing this. How do you estimate the entropy gain? So there's a droplet. You know, it exists somehow in your system. One way of doing it is imagining all possible ways in which you can embed this droplet in a system, basically. And if we're considering a thermodynamic limit, we have to define what that means. And so we can define that entropy as the number of different ways a single site, I, pick one site out of there, maybe this one. How many different ways can you associate that droplet with that site? Right? And that if you know, that number of ways that occurs is the number of accessible microstates, basically, in the system. And then the entropy is minus log of the number of accessible microstates. So that's the argument. Let me write it down. And by states, you know, I'm really talking about, I forget how I wrote this last time, but the set of all sigma basis states, sigma z basis states. So let's see, for one droplet, let's say in how many states is the spin I contained within the droplet? And in one dimension, this is fairly easy. You can imagine having a whole bunch of sites. This is your site I. So you can form the droplets by starting on site I and then doing a random walk. This sounds complicated, but you'll see why I'm doing this. So say I want a droplet of size L, and maybe L is 4, I don't know. I can imagine doing a random walk, one which randomly chooses between neighboring spins, and then stopping when L equals 4. That's the algorithm for choosing, 5, sorry, this is 5, right? Whatever your L is. And you can see, depending on how that random walk works, I could basically shift this window in L different ways around that site. It's almost too easy in one dimension, right? So in 1D, L states have site I in the droplet. So the entropy, I'll just write this even though I'm going to set it to 1. Is, if you remember thermodynamics, it's K log times the number of accessible microstates, which is L. That's always the definition of a configurational entropy. So this gives us access to our free energy. The energy is some constant for J. We can always define free energy up to some arbitrary constant. So let's define it up to E naught. So it's going to be, 4J, what did I say? 4J minus T times entropy, which is log L. Or now Pardal's argument goes like this. If you look at this formula, you see that there's you know, if you ever have a non-zero T, then you can increase L to basically counterbalance the first term, no matter what it is, no matter what your exchange constant is. So you can always grow L big enough to basically make the entropy dominate. And once the entropy dominates, it means that you don't have an ordered ground state anymore. It means that those droplets proliferate, or they grow to infinite size, which is kind of a paradox, because if the minority droplet's infinite, right, then you don't have a droplet. So then you have to say, well, then another droplet forms and tries to become infinite inside that droplet, right? And that proliferation of droplets is basically the mechanism by which the phase is destroyed. So on this simple free energy argument of pyrrols, any non-zero temperature destroys the ordered ground state.
Of some size, L.
So what it means for our phase diagram is, in the special case of one dimension, there's actually no phase boundary. There's no finite temperature phase transition. The ferromagnetic phase exists only at that single point at the origin. So for those of you studying like the toric code or topological order, Pyrrhel's argument is the same reason. It's the same mechanism by which basically two-dimensional topological order is unstable thermally, and it really has to do with the dimension of this boundary here. So in the toric code, you form, you know, if it's two-dimensional, you form droplets of minority phase, but the boundaries of those droplets are zero-dimensional, just like they are here. And that's why the two-dimensional toric code doesn't have any finite temperature transition. That topological order is only stable at zero temperature. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. We'll talk about that a bit at the end of the class when we talk about Z2 gauge theories. Okay, so our phase diagram's shaping up to be disappointing, but let's look at two dimensions. Okay, so this is all one dimensional, special case of 1D. So let's look at 2D and see what happens. Okay, so now we can imagine, instead of a length L that has a zero-dimensional boundary, we can imagine a droplet in two dimensions that has a one-dimensional boundary. So let's characterize the size of that droplet by that perimeter. So now the perimeter length is L. I don't know, something like this. So now we need the entropy energy cost. So if the perimeter is defined as the number of bonds cut by that boundary, then the energy cost is just 2J times L. So it's different than the one-dimensional case, where in the one-dimensional case, the energy cost was just the constant 4J. Okay, so that looks promising. But now we need to estimate the entropy gain. So it's the same argument as one dimensions. We're going to define the entropy as, for a droplet, how many states does site I have a downspin? In how many states does site I have a downspin? So we're going to pick an I. We're going to pick some site. And we can imagine forming a droplet like that with some length L. And of course, now it's, you can see how complicated it's going to be. So maybe this is your site I, and your random walk was here, 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 and back again. But you could also imagine other clusters that have basically the same length, that have different shapes and so on. So you somehow have to incorporate all those different shapes of clusters into this entropy estimate. How many distinct droplets with perimeter length L contain site I? There's other ways of estimating the entropy, but we'll continue with the way we did things in 1D. And all we need is a rough estimate. I just want to know order of magnitude, essentially. I want to know the functional dependence of the entropy on L. Okay? And that's enough to do the Pyrrhos argument. So just like 1D, construct droplets with a random walk on a 2D square lattice. So we want a boundary length L, and we imagine starting at site I, okay, and then doing a random walk. So we might do one step like this, whatever. We're moving around a square lattice, and we're forming droplets of some shape. Now for each step in that walk that I just did, you have four different choices of direction. Call them, I don't know, north, south, east, and west. Right? So every vertex has north, south, east, and west. So every time you do that random walk, you know, in the end, you want this thing to have a perimeter length L. And you construct it in such a way that, number one, you have all these different choices in how you make it, which gives you this gives you many possible random walks. So just this constraint gives you, it's 4 to the L, right? 4 to the L different random walks. Because for every time I make a choice, right, I have 4 different ways of making that choice. And I want L of them total. But actually, it's not quite 4L. There's more constraints, right? That's really just sort of an upper bound. So for example, let's see, after L steps, you have to return to the starting point. That's a big one. That distinguishes between a random walk that's like, you know, of length L like that, right? And a random walk that's length L like that. So that's a pretty important constraint. Because if you don't close that cluster, you know, L is the boundary somehow, right? So, you know, we want to form closed boundaries, minority droplets. It's hard to quantify that one. We can quantify other constraints if you look at each step in the random walk. So for example, you don't actually have 4 choices every time. You know, once you start that random walk from site I, you get to restrict yourself through no backtracking. Because that reduces your length. If you start up this path and then come back a ways and you're counting, right? So you'll count up the L faster than basically the length of the cluster. So if you avoid backtracking, which means only 3 directions to choose from, after the first step, it means like the tail, or the, you know, the history of your thing matters. So really, it's not 4; it's more like almost 3. But then there's actually additional constraints. So you know, instead of 3 to the L, there's actually, you know, in some cases, it's not, you don't want it to intersect. So if you don't want it to intersect, so if you're doing your random walk and you don't want to intersect the same path here, then you can't backtrack, you don't want to intersect, you only have 2 different choices here. You only have this choice and this choice. What I'm trying to say is it's going to be really hard to construct a proper estimate for the same thing that we did in 1D in 2D. This random walk's highly constrained. It's actually a non-trivial sort of combinatorial, like graph theory problem. So what I am convinced about is that we have some constant to the L different walks. And let's just call that thing C. and sees something like, you know, it's something between 1 and 4, and probably more accurately, it's something between 2 and 3. But let's just call it this constant C, okay? So now we can estimate our entropy just knowing this constant C. And that's the number of accessible microstates, or the number of states with site I in the cluster, if you want to call it that. So again, there's a Boltzmann constant that I'm going to set to 1. All right, so it's log C to the L. So it's so let's set KB equals to 1. So I'm going to call it L log C. So the only important thing I wanted to emphasize was that this is the form of the number of accessible microstates, C to the L. Now the free energy, we just E minus TS of that minority droplet. So it's 2JL minus temperature L log C. And there's L occurring in both terms. So I have L times 2J minus T log C. So it's very different than 1D in that I essentially have a balance between energy and entropy now. Okay, so in the one-dimensional case, all I had was a non-zero proliferation. In this case, there's essentially a critical temperature. So if the temperature is greater than 2J over log C, it's entropically advantageous. Is that a word? So the proliferation of droplets only occurs for temperatures greater than some critical temperature, which I don't even need to really know the form of C to determine. So in Parle's argument, he would say droplets proliferate and destroy the ferromagnetic phase. Okay? For T greater than that value. But if T is less than that value, essentially the energy wins. So it's energetically too costly to form the droplets. And then the ferromagnetic phase survives. So your spontaneous symmetry breaking survives up to some critical temperature. It's called a critical temperature, except that word critical is kind of loaded and implies a second order transition, which I haven't proven here. So sort of more accurately, it's a you know, it's a phase transition, or more generally, it's a phase transition. What is the value of the critical temperature? If I sort of take my best guesstimate for C, so if I assume somehow that, you know, if 2 is less than C is less than 3, so what, 2, let me say J equals 1, so 2 over log 3 is less than this critical temperature is less than 2 over log 2. That would mean, I just worked these numbers out. So T is the position of this phase transition. It's actually T over J, call it, critical. Do you know the exact value of that critical temperature? Anyone? Just from, I know you guys do at Mac. Do you know the critical value? Do you know the position of the phase transition of the 2D Ising model? All right, this is going on your permanent record. Giacomo knows it. 2.269. That's the Onsager temperature. Onsager, maybe? 2.269 something. Onsager basically, well, Kramers and Wanye determined that in 1941 before Onsager. I should give them credit. Dude, it's like World War II and everyone else was like doing World War II stuff and these guys are figuring out the TC of the 2D Ising model. But that's a huge sort of triumph of classical statistical mechanics, is determining that phase transition exactly. The Kramers-Wanye formulas, 2 over log 1 plus root 2 is 2.269. But Onsager solved the 2D Ising model exactly using transfer matrices.
So is that,
yeah, although I couldn't say off the top of my head, but there's definitely,
like, it doesn't depend on the structure of the material at all. It's just,
right, that's a good point. Yeah, we assumed a hypercube, but it really doesn't matter what that lattice is because the interactions are ferromagnetic. You know, it could have been a triangle, or it could have been a honeycomb or something like that. Yeah. So essentially, this type of critical point exists all over the place. And not just in magnets. If you take 705, then you'll realize what I mean by critical. You know, the sort of universality class or the symmetry breaking associated with this, you know, the Z2 spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs in all sorts of transitions, like the liquid gas transition and liquid crystals and all sorts of stuff like that. So the phase transition itself is very interesting. And it's basically the subject of an entire like class, you know. But you know, from our perspective here, all we've done is demonstrate the existence of this phase boundary through some simple free energy argument. And it's kind of, you know, we did a not bad job with sort of a really simple entropy counting path. So if you take a 705, you'll essentially derive this in some sense exactly. So this is the most important phase transition basically in StatMech and condensed matter. If you do the argument in three dimensions, you get the same thing. The functional forms aren't the same, but the phase transition exists. So you'll get some balance between energy and entropy if you do this random walk in three dimensions. Four dimensions, five dimensions, everything higher than one dimension gives you the existence of a phase transition. they call it a paramagnet to a ferromagnetic transition. So that's zero field. This is still classical. So we had some h over j, we're still figuring out. But it's a function of t over j. We're going to have some critical tc, or tc over j. Oh, no, I just called it tc over there. So I have some critical temperature. Below the critical temperature, I have the ferromagnetic phase where everything's aligned. And above it, I have what's called a paramagnetic phase. Or PM. So here there's a broken symmetry. The expectation value of sigma z is non-zero. And it's spontaneously broken. Above that, droplets proliferate. You just imagine these things, these minority phases, like, you know, existing and bubbling through the whole system. And that destroys the ferromagnetic phase. So this is basically called your order parameter. The expectation value of sigma, oh, it's an expectation value, sorry. So it has, I'm labeling the operator. It's the expectation value of sigma z's there. Spontaneously broken symmetry. The state retains the invariance of the Hamiltonian there. Okay, so that was a long haul just to get, you know, this boundary essentially. So what we're trying to do is extend this boundary, you know, up somehow into this non-zero transverse field, and that's where things get quantum. So we're mixing, as you can see, like classical stat mech and thermodynamics. And we're using all that knowledge. Now we have to mix it with quantum mechanics. And that's really the essence of quantum many-body theory in some sense. Let me just set this up, and we'll finish the phase diagram next time. Any questions on the phase transitions in the Ising model? Like I say, we essentially have a whole class. 705 is entirely, you know, on deriving these phase transitions, exploring questions of criticality, universality. I just want to remind us where we're going. We've set h equal to 0. Now, I don't remember if I was numbering these or what, but next, set t equals to 0, and h over j not equal to 0. And now we have quantum mechanics because, well, number one, sigma z and the Hamiltonian no longer commute. So we can't just throw everything in the language of sigma z. It's not just all spins, classical spins, up or down, you know what I mean? We have to worry about other spin states. So just to set this up, let's start with a small h field. So we'll start from the origin of the phase diagram, 0, 0, and we'll use perturbation theory, like proper quantum perturbation theory, to explore what happens when we turn on a finite H.
H is always a magnetic field, or can it be?
Well, in the spin system, it's a magnetic field. But like in if you had say particles hopping on a lattice, it could be a chemical potential. So there's many different physical things that give you the same symmetry operation as the magnetic field. Yeah, so chemical potential is kind of the other obvious one. So if you replaced all your spins up with a particle and your spin down with an empty lattice site, then this type of Hamiltonian, you know, is turning into a theory of particles on a lattice. And then you can add terms that are like hopping terms, which would be S plus S minus plus S minus S plus. And that would take this thing and hop it. And so that's actually the XY model, the thing I wrote before. That's another way of writing the XY model. And if these things are hopping around, according to that Hamiltonian, this XY Hamiltonian, then the magnetic field is a chemical potential, because it wants to put more particles on sites. Okay? And it can be mathematically entirely equivalent, but it's just another way of seeing, you know, another physical interpretation. So we'll deal with that later in the class when we talk about bosons. That's more like a bosonic Hamiltonian. So all I want to say is, okay, we're going to set this up by doing perturbation theory. And what we'll be asking is whether or not, I guess, the expectation value survives. So we'll ask whether sigma z I remains non-zero perturbatively. And that's it. It's as simple as that. So instead of doing a pyrrhos type thing, we're going to look at perturbation theory. And I'll look at perturbation theory in terms of this point in the phase diagram. And, you know, I'm not going to keep you in suspense. What happens is the ferromagnetic phase survives perturbatively as a function of h over j. And then we should look at the other limit when h is infinite. And we'll just write down the eigenstates. And those two things will be different, and we'll argue for a phase boundary existing somewhere on this axis here. And that's a quantum phase transition. That's your first quantum phase transition. It occurs regardless of the fact that you're at zero temperature. And quantum phase transitions have interesting properties that we'll kind of explore a lot in this class. So we'll continue with mapping out this phase. These phase diagrams, this phase boundary. And then we'll start explicitly writing down the quantum to classical correspondence of the transition field Ising model, I guess, next week. And I'll bring in you guys' first assignment. Okay, so the assignments will deal with the transition field Ising model, but they'll take ideas that we looked at in class, but like in any graduate course, they're going to require a lot of sort of research and resources that you guys will have to pull out of books and stuff on your own. And so generally, the assignments will be 2 weeks. So I'll give you an assignment probably Tuesday, and then it'll be due in 2 weeks. I'll give you another assignment. Okay? And that'll be the hard part of the class. Well, in addition to listening to me. Any other questions? Okay, see you guys Tuesday.